This podcast is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. If you'd like to help expand our programming, head to patreon.com/talkstarwars and become a TSW patron. You'll receive exclusive podcasts, access to a VIP Facebook group, monthly prize draws, Facebook Live sessions, and much, much more. Head to patreon.com/talkstarwars and become a TSW patron today, and the Force will be with you. Always.
It's the TSW Toy Box Podcast from Talk Star Wars. Each month, collect a brand new show, each released separately, featuring three hosts with movable arms and legs. Mark.
The Supreme Master, the Emperor.
Jeremy.
And he's got a lightsaber.
And moderated by Rob.
There's a trash monster.
It's the TSW Toy Box from Talk Star Wars.
Now I know the Force is with us.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Talk Star Wars Toy Box. This is the monthly version of the Toy Box show. We usually have Rob and Jeremy on, but unfortunately they're indisposed this month. But what we do have is a fantastic interview. So without any further ado, let's have a listen. I'm very pleased to have with me today a very talented writer, director and producer, the man behind Plastic Galaxy, Brian Stillman. Hello, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
How are you today?
I'm good. Enjoying the cool weather here in New York.
That's good. It's raining here, so not to worry. I'm sure our listeners already know about your work, but can you tell us something about you?
Well... I'm an Aries. I like long walks in the rain. I appreciate a good beer.
Oh, don't we all?
Favorite color is blue. No. what would you like to know? I mean, I guess the pertinent information. I certainly grew up loving Star Wars. I saw it in the theater. Barely remember it, but my dad corroborates the story. And saw all the others in the theater that I do remember. Always had the toys as a kid. Although eventually, like many of us, not all, but many, other toys came along and I was sort of wooed over by their extra joints and articulation and ability to transform into toasters or whatever.
Definitely.
But the fandom never left me, always
no.
A huge, huge, huge Star Wars fan. So just a very big part of my life. And that ultimately sort of was behind my interest in making the documentary and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's such a broad question.
When did you first start collecting?
In terms of getting back into the toys, I had them all as a kid when they were being produced. Not all, but I had a lot of them, certainly. And got out of them, as I got older, got into other things. Kind of came back to it, I guess, in 2008, 2009.
All right.
Can't say for certain. I can't really remember. But it was pretty late in terms of collecting. I mean, there was a lot of other stuff that I collected. And that was sort of taking all my space and money and everything else. And it wasn't until sort of, I went into a toy store and they had this amazing display of Star Wars toys. And I had kind of resisted them for a long time. I was collecting robots and ray guns from the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Right.
So really vintage stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Early, early first wave space toy stuff. And I was resisting drifting into the 70s, and that era when I was growing up. Because I figured I had those as a kid, and it just wasn't as interesting to me. But then I went into this toy store in New York City called Love Saves the Day. It was like a vintage store. So they had toys and they had like old clothing and they had magazines, all sorts of cool stuff.
Wow.
And they had this amazing display of Star Wars figures set up. They're all for sale. But they set them up in this display case on like the action stand and different play sets and spaceships, like really went all out. And it just kind of flipped the switch in my head at the time and made me remember how cool these things were. And I kind of resisted it for a while. And then one day at a comic book convention, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to buy an R2, because R2 is one of my favorites,
yeah,
both as the character and a figure. And it's a robot, and I collect robots, so that's safe. I'm not really not going anywhere new. Just another robot, no problem. And of course, that spiraled. And eventually, I was really, my goals were modest in the beginning. I wanted to get the original 21 figures. That yeah. was because that was what interested me—the really early wave of Star Wars yeah. stuff. And I wanted to get some early ships and early this and early that. So it spiraled, and then I started getting prototypes, and I started getting foreign things. I had a pretty big collection of Japanese stuff. I had prototype power droid runs. It grew much bigger than I expected it would, and so that's the collecting side of it for me.
So what pieces do you actually collect? Is it the vintage line? Specifically,
yeah I mean, originally when I was collecting, and I sort of backed out of it for money reasons and space reasons, and I collect other stuff and whatever, but my focus was really on the vintage figures, first 21 figures, with a few exceptions here and there. I Yoda, a couple droids that came out later, like 2-1-B and stuff like that.
Right.
So those early figures, I was also really interested in Japanese stuff.
Right.
Stuff being produced by Takara yeah. at the time.
The Wind Up Arto.
The die-cast things. Yeah.
Yeah.
There were three different R2s that Takara was making. There's a missile firing, yep. a little slideshow R2. There was the larger remote control kind of disc firing R2 yeah. that they had. There was a 3PO. There was a Vader. Vader was awesome because he comes with a crossbow, a glow in the dark crossbow. Because everyone remembers that scene in Star Wars where Vader looks at the crossbow. Yeah. He's like, well, my lightsaber's not going to do it here, so let me pull out the old crossbow. So it came with that, which I thought was super cool.
That'd have been a different film entirely.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if there was a rocket firing R2, that would have been a completely different film. It would have ended in the very first scene. They'd be on the blockade runner.
Yeah.
It's Vader, and R2 would be like, "I got this, yo." And that was it. Drop the mic.
Yeah,
just roll off into the sunset. So I really like the weird stuff. If I had the space to collect, I would have a collection just full of all the crazy, crazy things. Not necessarily just bootlegs, but crazy stuff that came out. A good friend of mine, Yehuda Kleinman, who's got an amazing collection.
Yeah.
He's got a case full of just bizarro, weird, like, why'd they even make that thing?
Really?
Stuff. Some of it bootlegs, some of it legit.
Yeah.
And I look at that case and I'm like, out of all the amazing stuff you have, I want some of the weird stuff that's in that.
Well,
so that's the stuff I tended to focus on. The other really big focus I had at the time was Power Droid. I love Power Droid. Love Gunk.
Everybody loves Gunk.
As a kid, that figure, something about it
yeah.
really, I'd say it really clicked with me, but that would be a bad pun because it's got the clicking legs.
The clicky
but I had
sound.
I had a first shot with a hand-cut sticker on it. That was like the prize of my collection.
Yeah,
I had four different proof cards, including a 20-back. So it really, that was like key for me. And I ended up selling it to Yehuda.
Really?
Yeah, almost everything I've sold has gone to Yehuda because he lives about 30 minutes away from me by subway. So I can visit it.
Yeah.
Which is important. He calls it the Brian Stillman wing of his collection. He's got a lot of my stuff. All my prototype stuff. Bunch of other things. Almost all my prototype stuff. So, yeah. That's the collection.
It sounds really interesting. I think I need to get your code, Yago Odor, on and have a word with him as well. The thing is, you see,
Yehuda's great to talk to.
Yeah, you see all these collectors, and they have the exact same 96 figures in the Detolf cabinet. But what you'd really want to see is something different, don't you? Some oddball items.
Yeah, although one of the things I learned when making Plastic Galaxy is, you know, I saw a lot of collections, traveling all over the place, seeing people's homes, seeing people's collections, Seeing the stuff that they focus on. And even the collections that have a lot of the same stuff, like you say, the same loose figures, maybe the same carded figures, yep, same ships, mm-hmm, the way people chose to display them, the way they chose to focus on them, really brought out people's personalities.
Right.
So you might have, you know, all your, the 96 figures all arrayed, I don't know, chronologically,
yeah,
alphabetically, I don't know, but other people might separate out those first 12 and put them on the display stand, yeah, or on the action stand, or maybe they display them, you know, with a couple spaceships, you know, like the Falcon or something like that. Or maybe, you know what I mean? Like, everybody sort of shines a light on different things in their collection.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what makes them feel unique.
Yeah, yeah. Good point there. I really do. I don't like to see people's collections, like you say, different focuses, really. Mine's the Bespin Luke.
Okay.
I have a special shelf just for my Bespin Lukes. Not just the Kenner line. I've got a lot of carded modern versions as well, and a couple of the Funko Pops. But we won't talk about those. Yes. So
what?
So what would be your favorite piece?
Well, I think my favorite figure was probably the DT Luke. Because, you know, I love the Luke Farm Boy figure.
Yeah.
As a kid, I always liked Luke more than Han. You know, I always liked the kid who had the dreams of going off into space, who was still excited by it all. And, so I love that figure to begin with. And then the DT thing has such a cool, like the double telescoping saber has such a cool history behind it and has such a cool kind of place in the hobby that, you know, it's not just that it's rare, it's there's a story behind it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This whole evolution of Luke's lightsaber, the most iconic weapon ever made in science fiction.
Definitely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you've got the lightsaber, you've got Doctor Who's sonic screwdriver, you've got the Star Trek phaser. You know,
yeah,
what I mean? And honestly, as cool as they all are, the lightsaber's the coolest thing.
Oh,
ever.
Of course it is.
So here you have this kind of neat figure with the accessory has this cool kind of thing behind it. That was always my favorite figure. I also really love the R2 figure, you know, just your basic R2-D2 figure, I think was great. That silver dome, you know,
yeah,
really made it stand out on the shelf. You have all these other figures that are these flat colors, you know, and just regular paint apps. And then, you know, 3PO and R2, you have this great shining chrome sort of brightness on your shelf, you know, and I just love the R2 figure.
Oh yeah.
Also up there, you know, the Japanese, the Takara wind-up R2,
yeah,
is one of my all-time favorite figures because it's so strange. They turn his legs into arms. I mean, the whole thing's bizarre. I love that figure. And I always loved the Mexican, the Lily Letty 12-inch scale R2. Kenner, for their large R2, they re-sculpted the whole body.
Yep.
You know, they gave it all this detail and everything else. Has a little hatch that opens in the back. Well, Lily Letty, all they did was they took the regular old, regular scale R2 and blew it up.
Yep.
It's got the sticker. It's got everything. It's just literally, it looks like a store display
because
It's this freaking giant R2. I love that thing. It's so weird and so cool. You know, I've sold a lot of my collection over the years. And the pieces that I have not touched, and I don't think I could ever get myself to sell, are that Lily Letty R2, the big one,
yep.
And the Takara R2.
Right.
And then the very first R2 that I bought when I got back into Star Wars, I still have. I've sold all the figures that appeared in Plastic Galaxy that I owned. I sold those. I sold the ones that are on the cover.
Right.
I decided to pass those all along. Broke up my prototype collection. I was comfortable doing that. Because when you're an independent filmmaker, you basically look at all your stuff and you think, okay, if I want to keep making movies, something's got to go.
Yeah.
And like I said, I collect other things that for me take some priority.
Yeah.
But those figures, those I'm keeping. They're not going anywhere. Oh, they're just
no.
So weird and cool and fun. I sold my early bird set. You know, it's. You know, the funny thing about that is I looked around and I realized I was never going to build the type of collection I wanted to build.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately included like prototypes. you know, it was like deep end of the pool. And so that made it easier to sell some of the stuff too. I was like, you know what? Let's put these in the hands of people who are building collections.
Yeah.
Where they're really going to build the collections they want to build.
That's the way the community is, isn't it?
Yep. That was sort of my thinking. So yeah.
Well, I've got an R2-D2 t-shirt on today just just to help you along there. I know you can't see it, but I have.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
So, how do you? I know you've seen a lot of displays on your travels. How do you display your collection?
It was a constantly evolving process because I had to fit it in with the other collections that I have. I have an entire wall devoted to the vintage robots and ray guns, like the old Japanese tin stuff. And then I have another wall that has a lot of original art on it from old pulp magazines, and stuff like that. So at the time it was like, those can't move. Like literally, I cannot move those. So I ended up having to carve out a display for the Star Wars stuff. And I did what most people do, you know, for a while I had a detail going, and then at one point I had a Billy case going. Luckily my collection was not huge, so I was able to display. I mean, some people's collections, I don't know what I would do with them. They're massive. And you know, I live in a small apartment in New York City, so there's just not a lot of space. I was so envious. I'd go to people's houses and see their collections, and they'd have like an entire basement that they could use, or an attic, or just, you know, two rooms in the house. I was like, you guys don't know how lucky you have it to have space. I have a 12 by, I don't know, 8 foot room, which is a nice room to have in Manhattan, believe me. But if you're a collector like myself, it's like, you know, you might as well be in a cardboard box. So, but I managed to display it all. Because I kept it so focused, and that's one of the reasons I kept it so focused on just that early stuff, I was able to make it all work on a couple cases. And, you know, I kind of built out around the original 12, the early bird set, and the power droid run. And I kind of sort of built it from there. You know what I mean? Like I said, okay, these are central. These are the things I love the most. Let's sort of make that the core, and then arrange spiraling out, so to speak. You know, part of my collection, and I obviously am not ever going to sell this, I have a piece of the original Death Star, the shooting model they used. I have one of the small pieces, and that was part of the collection, you know, so I'd work that in. You know, so certain props and production items were part of my collection.
Fantastic.
Still are part of my collection. And those were kind of part of it, and I'd work those in. So I wanted to, you know, it's funny. I saw a lot of collections, like I said, and some people would arrange things very specifically. Like everything had this sort of clear logic to it, you know.
Yeah.
Like all the figures are here, the ships are here. There's a lot of clarity, and I thought those were beautiful displays. But then I saw photos of another collector who went for a more jumbled display. It wasn't that he just crammed everything on the shelves. That was clearly not what was happening. But he mixed and matched and kind of put things together that you wouldn't expect. So yeah, everyone displays, you know, Han next to Chewie, or their big head Han versus their next to their small head Han, or, you know, R2 next to 3PO, like sort of these pairings that make a lot of sense. I did the same thing. This guy might have put, you know, the 3PO here next to the like toothbrush set, and the R2 over there next to the whatever. And it was this sort of at first glance insane, but the more you looked at it, the more you realized it wasn't random. There was this kind of aesthetic going on. So it wasn't connected necessarily by logic. It was connected by aesthetics. And it blew my mind. And I've always loved that display. I don't even know how like his brain worked to make that happen. And then I would go to, I'd see people's displays, and I always was impressed by this, but I never had the space to do it. People who set up dioramas. So they'll set up like, you know, they'll have multiple figures and they'll set up like the whole cantina display, you know, and they'll do the cantina playset and all the figures that go in there. And then they'll set up, you know, the Hoth World set, or the Cloud City, you know, the old Sears set or whatever. Or they'll have the like early bird set up, you know, with all the figures on that. That always blew my mind. And then people, the ones that really impressed me, are the ones who had set up dioramas with scenes from the movies they didn't even make play sets for. They just bought all the ships, everything they needed, modern, vintage, didn't matter. And they'd put in all this work. So some ships would be hanging and, you know, they'd have like other things here. And one guy was reproducing the scene from Phantom Menace where they're all like underwater, you know, going to the place. And he had all the figures suspended by fishing lines, so it looked like they were swimming. Like, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. Super, super cool, even if that movie was a terrible, 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 terrible thing. The display blew the movie out of the water. I couldn't believe it. So stuff like that I always thought was super cool.
Fantastic. So where'd you buy your items?
Oh, everywhere. I bought a couple pieces. Ironically, I didn't buy that much from that toy store that first inspired me from Love Saves the Day, because they were really expensive. They had overpriced their stuff left and right. So I was like, you know, thanks a lot for the push, guys, but you're not getting a dime from me. I might have bought maybe one or two figures from them. And then there were a couple local comic book stores that had a couple figures. I bought one or two from them. But most of it, you know, a lot of eBay sales. A lot of my collecting was before the Facebook groups became big. Like the Imperial Commissary and stuff like that. Yeah, all the places where you can buy toys now on Facebook were not there. I bought a lot of stuff through Rebel Scum, through the wanted boards, the for sale boards. I bought a lot of stuff from them. But as I got deeper into the hobby, you start becoming friends with more people. And if they sell stuff, they're like, hey, I know you're looking for, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you need like the hollow tube Tusken Raider. I got one. I'm selling it. You interested? Cool. And then they hook you up and maybe, you know, knock a few bucks off. You start becoming friends with dealers. And they're like, hey, I know you're into this sort of stuff. Before I offer it to everyone, I just want to let you know I have all this Japanese stuff. Do you want any of it? or what are you looking for? Maybe I can find it for you.
Yeah.
So that became a big part of it. Smaller, I don't want to say smaller dealers, but not some of the dealers who are like people first think of, you know, like, so Andy Loney, I bought a lot of stuff from him. Him and his sister Alyssa, a lot of stuff from Todd Chamberlain. I bought a lot of stuff from James Gallo. So those are all like dealers who are at like every convention. They're all over the place. I bought a bunch of stuff from Joe Iglesias, who's a huge bootleg collector, but he also finds all sorts of weird stuff. He hooked me up with a bunch of cool things. And then eBay, you know, always eBay.
Yeah.
There's always stuff on eBay.
It also goes back to eBay, doesn't it?
Well, you know, you're up late at night. It's like either that or you go crack, one or the other. So.
I've been in touch with eBay recently because I'm trying to get them to stop selling reproduction. I know it's a big hard task, but somebody's got to try and stop
it. You know, but here's the thing. Reproductions in Star Wars are a big problem. But in a lot of other hobbies, reproductions are not seen as a terrible thing. So from eBay's point of view, they're like, well, you know, how are we it's supposed just to Star approach Wars. This? You know, in the toy robot world, reproduction parts are not too big a deal. You're dealing with toys that are, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old.
Yeah.
Occasionally, you buy a repro part. It's not seen as a big deal as long as you disclose it when you sell it. And you can usually tell the difference between a real 70-year-old part and a fake 70-year-old part. Not too tough. And maybe that's why it's not such a huge problem. The fact that you can kind of tell.
Did you hear about the Princess Leia blaster that's been going about, the Palatoy one?
No.
No, there's a big hoo-ha about that. Seller was selling 7 of them, and I actually bought one of them, funnily enough. It was on the Vintage Rebellion this week that told the whole story about it. It's a very interesting story, but thousands of them have hit the market. But it does float, it looks really good. There's just one bit about it that's a bit thick at the back, but it's just an excellent reproduction, really.
You know, it is an unavoidable part of this sort of inexorable forward march of technology and desire for profit. You know what I mean? And I think it's something that the hobby is going to have to figure out how it's going to come to terms with, because you're going to reach a point where someone's going to make a reproduction that you just cannot tell the difference from. And you're going to know that the repros are out there because suddenly there are 50 million of these things that there weren't, you know, 50 million of before. So you're going to say, well, some of them have to be fake. But if you can't tell that the one you have is fake, like if you literally cannot, like no test has come up that allows you to tell.
Yeah.
How do you handle that? Do you say, screw it? It might just, you know, there's an equal chance it's real. And you just accept it and you say, well, you know, whatever, it's not going to affect the value because we don't know if it's real. We don't know if it's fake. Everyone wants to assume it's real, of course. You know, you want to hope that yours is real. So you just does that become no longer part of the valuation of this item and you just say, screw it? Or does it tank all the value of this thing and you say, well, there's nothing we can do about that either. I have no horse in that game, generally speaking. So I'm sort of more curious to see what happens. I don't know what the answer is, but I'm curious to see when we reach that point where you just can't tell the weapons, what happens? How does a hobby kind of react to that? You know,
it's a big problem. It's the same with the bubbles. I mean, they're going to drop off one of these days. The glue's going to erode and the bubbles are going to drop off and everybody's going to have loose figures.
Yeah, there's that. Or they're all going to start yellowing or who knows?
Yeah.
You know? It's, you know, we ascribe a lot of value to these things that are by their nature designed to fall apart. They're not meant. No one imagined that anyone would care 40 years later. Now, that said, there's the argument for doing what we can to preserve it, because if you are lucky enough in 100 years to have that one figure where the bubble has not fallen off somehow, then, you know, it behooves you to be careful with it. But most people display their figures, you know, they're loose. Let's say they have carded figures. They put them in, forget about AFA for a moment, but let's say they just put them in, you know, nice acrylic cases.
Yeah.
You still have the weight of the figure pushing down on this bubble. And the only thing holding it in place is 40-something-year-old glue.
Yep.
that was not designed. You know, it was designed to be easily torn open.
Yeah, we glad to tear it open, but...
Yeah, so at some point, all those figures are going to push those bubbles right off those cards.
Of course they are. These are the problems we face in collecting.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention, the plastic in the bubble will eventually, somehow, I'm sure, start to react with the plastic in the figures.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot that can eventually start to happen. And it's probably going to take another, you know, could take 50 years, but just never know. Yeah,
but it will happen.
You never know.
So,
on that bummer of a note.
So, is there anything you are currently looking for? Have you got a Holy Grail piece that you need?
Not really. You know, the stuff that I would consider a grail is so far out of my price range as to not even be worth considering. You know, and that's one of the things that's happened to the hobby. So much collecting money has come into it recently over the last few years that prices have just gone crazy to the point where I look at it and I say, you know what? It's not worth it for me. For that money, I can buy a prop. You know,
yeah.
I can buy something from like a movie. And the stuff that I would really want is so locked up in other people's collections that the money just isn't there to pry it loose. So I've reached a point in my collecting where I'm just comfortable with the stuff that I have and sort of happy to watch other people unearth these things and put them out there. You know, it's, I'm fine with that. You know, not everyone can have everything. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I'm comfortable with my place in the collecting universe. You know, where like Plastic yeah. Galaxy has not made me a millionaire where I can suddenly go out and buy,
no.
you know, that Power Droid, you know, wax sculpt or something like that. Like, it's never going to happen. So that's cool. You know, it's sort of recognizing that it's cool to know this stuff is there and to feel like yeah. I don't have to own it. You know, you go to a museum and you don't look at the Mona Lisa and man, how do I snag
that's
that?
That's not mine.
You know, you look at it, you say, awesome, I got to see it. So I go to enough people's collections where I get to see this cool stuff and it's like, all right, cool. You know, if I owned it,
definitely,
all I'd be doing is looking at it anyway.
Yeah,
so
that's a really,
you know what I mean?
Good,
like, I'm not playing with these toys. It's not like I need to own it so I can play with it. obviously, we want to own these things. We're collectors. But I've reached a point where I'm sort of comfortable with that, and I get less stressed out about it than I used to. You know, it used to be something would come up, and you'd be like, oh my God, your heart would start racing, and you'd figure out, okay, what do I have to sell? What do I have to do? How do I hustle to make this happen? Do I really need both lungs? Can I get by with one? You know, do I need my liver? Like, really? Like, I don't drink as much as I used to, so I kind of feel like I can maybe get away of not having a liver. And you start freaking out until you get the thing. And there's still things out there where I do that. I mean, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the Star Wars stuff, I said, you know what? I'm cool.
Yep.
I don't have to have this stuff. Another thing, and this has sort of been a more recent kind of understanding I've come to. I've been collecting stuff for a long, long time. And we let our identities get wrapped up in our collections where we become known as the whatever guy. Like, I'm the Lobot guy. Like, well, okay, guy, if you really want to be. I'm the mating guy. It's like, you know, or whatever. But we, you know, or whatever it is you collect, I'm the ray gun guy, I'm this, I'm that, and that becomes part of what we're known for, part of our personality. And then one day we reach this point where we look at that stuff and we say, you know, I've kind of been there, I've done that, I've got everything, or everything I'm likely to get, and I'm just not excited, and I'm really more excited, you know, I was the mating guy, but now I'm like really getting into Yoda. Like, the figure's more interesting, the character's more interesting, pretty much everything's more interesting than me. Right now, there's some mating collector out there going, screw you, Brian! ragging on mating. But the thing is, as collectors, we sometimes have trouble shifting that focus because we're like, well, if I do that, am I not that guy anymore? And am I comfortable? And it's even bigger when you say, well, I think I want to sell my collection. It's not just that I want to shift focus and still hold on to all that mating stuff. I want to sell that mating stuff because all the money that I've got tied up in mating, I could put into Yoda. And, you know, I've got everything. He's just sitting on my shelf now. And I've enjoyed it for so long. And I've been proud of it for so long. But now it's just like, hey, bearded guy, how's it going? You know? And maybe you want to sell, but you don't necessarily want to lose that part of how you're seen in the hobby. And that's something that I think once you've reached that point, I start to think maybe you're drifting into the wrong reasons for collecting. It's not about becoming that guy. It's about the love of the object. And if your love for mating has gone, if it's, you know, fleetingly drifted off with the wind, or if you feel like you've accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish, you shouldn't be worried about letting it go. If that's what you want to do, you know, obviously if you still dig it, then hey, cool, awesome. You know, I mean, I have a lot of stuff that just sits on my shelves and I look at it every day and it makes me smile. That's great because you still have the love of the object. You're not tied up in your identity. And then there's some people where it's part of your identity, but that's because you're still hardcore into it. And that's great too. But I think you always have to remember it's about you collect because you love the thing. And if the love isn't there anymore, don't be afraid to shift to the things that you do love, you know, a different area of Star Wars or something else entirely. I mean, if that's what it is, that's what it is. You know, your friends will still be your friends. You know, you'll still, no one's going to judge your love of Star Wars because you decided to sell off a bunch of stuff. It's all cool. And that's something that's come to me recently. Actually not relating to Star Wars, is selling off some stuff from some of my other collections.
Right. That's great advice. So you mentioned Plastic Galaxy there. Can you tell us all about that? How did it happen?
Sure.
What made you make such an interesting documentary?
So like I said before, I got back into Star Wars by, you know, seeing some toys at this cool store and eventually picking up stuff at this comic book shop. My collection started to grow. And I'm one of those people who, when I collect, I like to learn the history of this stuff. That's why I love prototypes, because I love learning about how these things came to be. So I read every book. I try and talk to every collector I meet, you know, just like, tell me about your collection. Mm-hmm. Okay, you focus on Jawas. Cool. What's interesting? Besides, like, I look at Jawa and I think Jawa's awesome. Oh, there was this story about the vinyl cape. That's fascinating. You know, I mean, everyone's got to learn that for the first time. So
of course.
All that stuff is what I love. And I bought Sansweet's books and I read all of those. I bought Gus and Duncan's books. I read all of those. At the time, I read Rebel Scum and I read through the Star Wars Collector's Archive. And I became friends with a bunch of collectors. I lucked out. And early on, I just happened to meet a couple collectors who were part of that world, the Star Wars Collector's Archive world. So they taught me a ton of stuff. Particularly John Alvarez. He was a huge collector, and he really kind of answered a lot of my questions and introduced me to a ton of people, really got me involved heavily in the Star Wars scene. And in doing all that, I said to myself, you know, these toys are 40 years old, or however old they were at the time. Someone has to have made a movie about this stuff. They just had to have. And I want to see it. So I looked around and I found a few small YouTube videos and some news reports, you know. And that was it. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. And and immediately, you know, I'm a journalist. That's what I do. And at least I was at the time. I'd been a magazine writer and editor for Guitar World magazine for more than 10 years. I was doing video news in New York City for whatever, 5 years, 6 years, like doing that for a long time. So all of a sudden my news producer hat sort of fell onto my head. I was like, well, if nobody else has done this, and if I want to learn about this stuff anyway, maybe I can do it. And I'd never done anything that long before, but I said, you know, how hard could it be? Ha, right? That was famous last words. But my thinking was, this will give me a chance to go out and actually interview all these people. And then, sort of as a bonus, I can share all that with other people so they can learn all this stuff too. You know, so I'll talk to some Kenner guys, and this way all these other people can listen to these Kenner guys and maybe learn something. So I said, okay, why not? And, you know, I got to combine this thing that I do for a living with this hobby that I love. And, that was sort of the launch of it all. And then it was diving into the trenches.
So you reach out to all the collectors that you knew interview.
That was the first step. I knew early on there were a couple bigger collectors I wanted to talk to. People who, you know, when you're making a movie like this, you can't just talk to any and all collectors. Because the truth is, you only have so much time. You know, if you interview 1,000 people, that means 995 of them are going to get sort of left in the cutting room floor through no fault of their own. Yeah. So what I really wanted to do was interview people who had great collections, but who also could tell this story, who I knew had the facts. They had done the research. They really knew what they were talking about. And at the same time, I knew I wanted to interview collectors who were like myself, people who just loved the toys. They didn't have books. They didn't run websites. They didn't do anything like that, but they truly loved this stuff. Because I wanted to capture the kind of passion behind collecting and behind these toys. And then the third leg of it all, I knew I wanted to get at least some Kenner people. You know, you wanted to get people who were there, first-person accounts of doing this stuff. And I figured that, more than anything, you know, fans would be happy to see, because it's stuff you don't normally get to see. You don't normally get to hear from Jim Swearengin or Tom Troy or any of these people. So that was sort of my game plan. And I lucked out early on. I knew some people who knew Gus Lopez, and they were able to help me hook up with him. I knew some people who knew Ron Salvatore. They helped me hook up with him, Chris Fawcett. And then at the same time, I was becoming friendly with people like Bobby Sharp and John Booth. Couple other people appeared in the movie, and so I said, okay, that covers some of that. And then a friend of mine who was helping me on the film, Carl Tate, who is the senior producer on the film and an art production designer, he was doing some digging online, and he came across an article that Jim Swearengin's college wrote about him. And we were like, oh, well, he's still in Cincinnati. He's still active. Let's see if we could track this guy down. And I lucked out and got a hold of him and was able to drop a few people's names. And he said, okay, well, that sounds interesting. And then someone hooked me up with Steve Sansweet, and it kind of built from there.
Cool.
And, you know, you just sort of see where it takes you. The reaching out part, though, was surprisingly easy.
Really?
You get lucky, and you meet people who introduce you to more people. You know what I mean? So once you get that ball rolling, it's like, oh, I know another Kenner guy. I can hook you up with him. You know, or whatever.
I suppose it is, yeah. Yeah. This is probably pre-Facebook community days.
It was all pre-Facebook. I didn't even belong to Facebook. I joined Facebook because I realized if I was going to properly promote Plastic Galaxy, I needed a Facebook page.
Yeah.
So I was like, I had no social media presence at all until I made that movie, or until I started working on that movie. And there were no Facebook groups. It was all Rebel Scum. You know, I would post to Rebel Scum. I'd be like, hey, guys, I don't know if anyone cares, but I have a preview. You know, I've cut this little trailer for this movie I'm working on, and I'd get like 10,000 hits. I was like, oh, I guess people care. Okay.
Fantastic.
I guess I have to get this thing done. That was the crazy part. Like, it's so funny. I thought I wasn't sure anyone would care. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, some people will care, obviously. But I didn't think, I was like, you know, if I'm lucky, I'll sell like 500 copies of the DVD, you know. I didn't imagine we'd have streaming distribution at the time, so I wasn't even thinking about that. I was like, I hope I make my money back. I hope anyone watches this stupid thing. And it was like, I had no idea. I had no clue how much people would sort of be interested. Whether they liked it or not, they at least wanted to check it out and see it. And luckily, most people seemed to enjoy it. So it kind of took me totally off guard. But obviously, it's very gratifying.
It is a fantastic documentary, I must
admit. Thank you. I appreciate that. My big fear at the time was, I just want to make sure that if anyone watches it, even if they hate it, they don't hate it because I got stuff wrong. You know what I mean? Or or whatever. Like, if they hate it, if they're like, man, his editing sucks, and, you know, his camera angles suck, and he can't tell a story, but all the facts in there are correct. I was like, that'll be a victory. If it's, you know, it might be unwatchable, but if you can suffer through it, you will at least learn something. And, you know, luckily people think that it's entertaining, and that's great. I'm glad I pulled that off. But I was like, I just don't want anyone to be pissed because I like put terrible information out there. So at least I got that right.
Well, it's certainly entertaining. Have you ever thought about doing other licenses, like the Palitoy license?
You know, it'd be fun. You know, and that sort of goes hand in hand with the question people always ask me, are you ever going to do a sequel? My interest in Star Wars was always in that transformative moment where it went from being this like kind of crazy dream to being the world's biggest toy line at the time. And to me, that's the story of the Kenner vintage line. Now, the other stuff is super interesting. But I'm not sure I'm the person to make it. You know, right. I'm not as interested in the modern stuff. Because honestly, the modern stuff exists because why wouldn't it exist?
Yeah.
We live in a world where if you have an action movie or a science fiction movie or an adventure movie, whatever, you have toys. You just
figures of it. Yeah.
It's just part of the machine. So as far as I'm concerned, there's not a lot of story there. Now, that said, being able to talk to the guys who design even the modern stuff today would be a lot of fun. Like, it's still, hey, you made this awesome toy. That's fascinating. So I don't mean to kind of discredit that. But from a bigger narrative point of view, you know, we have a toy industry, and it's because of Star Wars. Like, it's because of the vintage stuff, this position we're in today. As far as the foreign stuff goes, part of it is it's just really hard for me to do that movie because it would cost me a zillion dollars.
Yeah, true.
Like, if I wanted to do Palitoy, I'd have to be in the UK. And if I'm going to be in the UK, that means a lot of transatlantic flights.
True.
I mean, it's expensive enough flying all over the country here. But to go back and forth to London or to England, different parts of England, I'd go broke, like, instantly. especially with the exchange rate and everything else. I mean, it'd be impossible for me to do. But I always tell people, if anyone else out there wants to make a movie about another part of Star Wars, call me and I'll be happy to answer like any questions. I'll give you advice. If you've never made a documentary before, I will give you a crash course in movie making. I will tell you how I managed to get a hold of people. I will give you any sort of background information I can to help you make that movie, because I want to see the damn thing. You know, if someone made a movie about Palitoy or about Lily Letty or any of these toys, I'd be like, yeah, I want to watch that. So I will do anything I can to help you make that so that I have something to like see. Totally self-serving. I want to watch the movie. So I think there's stories out there to be told. And I'm a little surprised. And I will say a tiny bit disappointed that nobody has picked up the slack yet to do it. Because if I can make this movie, Like, anyone can. I made it with the help of a couple friends. Like, I certainly don't want to claim that I made it all on my own, but I didn't have a studio behind me. I didn't have $1 million behind me. Yeah. You know, with Kickstarter, you can raise the money. It's not that hard. And if you're like, well, I don't know how to make a movie, dude, call me. In a week, I'll teach you to do it. You know what I mean? Like, these things should be happening. And I'm starting to feel like we're running out of excuses to not have those other movies out there. So come on, people, get on it.
Yeah, your budding producers and directors out there, there's stories to be told.
Yeah, everyone who's doing YouTube channels, everyone who's doing like video blogs and stuff like that, you're like one step away from being able to make a documentary. Like, you've got the basic skills in place. So come on, you know, step up. I did it. I did it. Have you got any? Survived.
Have you got anything else in the pipeline?
Yeah, I'm currently working on a documentary about the art and artists of Dungeons and Dragons. A couple partners and I have paired up, and we're working on that. It's called Eye of the Beholder, and we've been interviewing D&D artists and people involved in the game going back to the 70s. So sort of Plastic Galaxy for that world. I'm a big gamer, love D&D, played it all my life. So that's been quite a thrill for me to meet all these artists. And then I'm also part of, I'm a consulting producer. I've done some shooting and stuff for the new Netflix series that's coming out, The Toys That Made Us.
Yeah, so I've heard about that.
It's, you know, I'm not allowed to say much about anything yet.
I know, I've reached out to them and they can't tell me anything about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is coming out. It is, they're getting ready at some point to launch. You know, it's a real thing. I cannot say much, but I have seen some early cuts of a couple episodes and they're freaking awesome. And that's literally all I can say about it. I can't even say which episodes I've seen, but they're doing a great job. Everyone involved in it loves toys. The guy who owns the production company that that Netflix hired is called Nacelle. Yes, for you Star Trek fans, it is named after the nacelles on the Enterprise, the warp drives. The guy who owns the company, Brian Volkweiss, is a huge toy fan and a huge Star Trek fan and a huge Star Wars fan and everything. So he's our age. He grew up with this stuff. So he's in it. Like, he's not just some like studio executive who's like, I can make money off of this. He's like a guy who's like, I want to make a show about this because, I mean, he makes shows for a living. That's what he does. But like, I love this stuff. Same reason I made Plastic Galaxy. The funny story is we became friends because he wanted to license Plastic Galaxy for distribution, and a company had already gotten to it. I already signed a digital distribution deal. So I had to turn him down, which, by the way, is something I never imagined I'd be doing. Never thought I'd be turning down a Hollywood like distribution deal. It's like because someone already came along. But I was like, you know, sorry, dude. I already signed with your competitors. But then we started talking and realized we loved all the same stuff. And then, you know, a few years later when he called me and said, listen, I want to bring you on board, particularly with the Star Wars episode, obviously. I want to have you do some shooting. You know, I've done some shooting for their episode on Lego and for Star Trek and for G.I. Joe. I was like, boom, I'm there, because I know that you guys are going to put your heart into this. This is not just going to be the crappy 40-year-old virgin story that, you know, makes collectors want to like punch our fists through walls. It treats this stuff with respect. And they really dig into corners. They got stuff that I did not get for Plastic Galaxy. And that pisses me off. Like, I'm just like, oh, you talked to who? You did what? On the other hand, I got a few things they didn't get. So you need to watch both. There's something in both for everyone.
We will do.
But yeah, it's great. So I'm totally hyping their show. And if Brian hears this, send me a check, man. This is free advertising. But no, so that's what I've been working on that. I'm really excited about that. And So those are the two projects, that and Eye of the Beholder are the big ones.
Fantastic. So, where can people find you?
Oh, man. Well, stalkers can come to my address. I'm the usual places, Facebook. I'm terrible at Twitter. I'm on Twitter, but I'm, like, the worst tweet person ever. This bird does not sing. But Facebook's the easy one. Facebook.com/plastic galaxy movie? Plastic Galaxy? I don't know. It's not hard to find. I'll put
things up in the show notes for it.
Thanks.
Links like, to it.
Brian's terrible at promoting his own URLs, so I'll do it for him, loser. And plasticgalaxymovie.com. That's our website. Right. And, you know, the truth is, if you want to watch Plastic Galaxy, the easiest, I mean, we're on Amazon, Amazon Prime, iTunes, Hulu, Vudu, Vimeo. I mean, we're all over the place except Netflix. Screw you, Netflix. So if you have Amazon Prime, I always tell people watch it on that because then it's free and I still make money.
Yep.
So everyone's happy.
Oh,
I'm so bad at promoting myself. I'm like, whatever.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah, go watch it with friends.
The only reason I'm on Twitter is to annoy Mark Hamill. So.
Well, then. Great. It's funny. We were trying to get Plastic Galaxy onto the same channel that he's on the Comic-Con. What is it? Comic-Con HQ?
Oh, right, yeah.
And I don't know if it's happened. But my distribution company, Gravitas, they seemed pretty confident. I was like, well, the truth is, it's probably not going to make you very much money. I was like, I don't care. I'm going to be on the same channel as a show with Mark Hamill. I don't care if they don't pay me anything. That's the coolest thing ever. My movie about Star Wars toys is going to be on the same channel as a show hosted by Luke Skywalker. Done. And they're like, well, we're not going to tell them that you'll do it for free. I was like, whatever. But I'll do it for free. I was like, I don't care. So I don't know. Hopefully that'll happen. If anyone out there sees it on that channel, please let me know. Because I never find out if these things work out till one day someone's like, dude, you're on Hulu. I met one of the producers of Mark's show at Celebration this year. And he's a toy collector, a guy named Scott Kinney, and he's awesome, awesome guy, super friendly, and has one of the most amazing toy collections I've ever seen. And we were talking, cool. And I was like, "Hey, so can I give a can you give a copy of my film to Mark Hamill?" Which is like the ballsiest thing I could think of. And we'd been having this long conversation, and suddenly it was like you could hear the record scratch. It was like, "Rrr!" And he looked all uncomfortable. I was like. He's like, okay, yeah, whatever. I was like, I'm going to sign it to him. And you could see Scott getting, like, a little paler. He's like, dude, not cool. I was like, no, I got this. So I signed a copy. And he's like, well, you know, they don't like to take a lot of stuff from all the people at conventions. I'm like, no, it's cool. So I'm sure Scott was like, oh, my God, I'm not going to give this to Mark. But that's fine. Scott's still cool in my book. But I can't believe I did that. I was like, afterwards, I was like, I might have just really embarrassed myself. Whatever. It's cool.
It's Mark Hamill. Don't worry
about Mark, I'm going to be on your channel. It's going to be awesome, man. We'll see each other at Hollywood parties. I'll be like, hey, have you watched my show? I'll be like, no. I'll be like, all right. Mark Hamill said no to me.
He liked one of my tweets the other day, and that was the nearest I've got to him. I queued up for 3 days at Celebration and still didn't get his autograph.
Ooh. Ouch.
I got Carrie Fisher's instead, so
that worked out
pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, especially in light of everything, that's great.
Yeah.
I never got to meet... I've only gotten autographs. I don't generally chase autographs. I've only gotten autographs from Kenny Baker and...
Yeah, I've got that.
from Anthony Daniels, and yeah. and that means a lot to me because droids, big droid fan, especially Kenny. You know, it's like yeah. you know, that meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
But I've never met. I never got to meet Carrie Fisher. I haven't met Mark Hamill or any of them.
No.
It's the lines are just so damn long. That's part of it.
It certainly are.
You know, so, but, you know, as everyone's getting older, start thinking about that. It's like, huh, maybe. So.
Yeah, I'm going to a Star Wars collector, like, convention type sellers thing in a couple of weeks. There's going to be Paul Black there, a few of the other actors, Ken Coley, so like that. So I'm hoping to get a few interviews from them.
Cool.
For the podcast.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. I get the Black Series signed. I've got Dave Prowse, all the you know the usual Boba Fett. Got Chewbacca.
Sure.
Got R2, 3PO. I've got most of them signed.
I did get to meet. I got to meet Chewie.
Yeah,
that's pretty awesome.
I got to Kenny Baker's a couple of weeks before he died.
Oh wow!
And it was terrible when I just knew. I knew as soon as I saw him that
he didn't have
long. No, unfortunately.
No. Well. Yeah.
Right. So, thank
we
you very much.
We keep ending these things on bummers, man. We got to.
Oh, no.
Whatever. December, got a new Star Wars coming out. That's always exciting.
It is. I've got one question, one last question, which I always end on. What vintage figure would you be?
Would I be? Ooh. Yes. I have never been asked that. All right. What vintage figure would I be? And not the character, the figure.
The figure, yes.
Well, clearly not mating. Man, if I could be any vintage figure. I'm taking this one seriously. I'm giving this some thought.
Of course. Of course, you need to.
Oh, man. I think that's a hard one.
It is.
I think I would be R2. He was just cool, and everyone loves him. And, you know, his head made a cool clicking noise, and nobody else got to make cool clicking noises. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be the Han figure, because everyone would always dunk me in water and freeze me, because that's what you do. Farm Boy Luke would be a cool figure to be, but everyone would always lose my weapon. That would suck. You know, I'd be tempted to say Vader, but the sculpt on Vader is so weird. He's all skinny and like strange. Yeah. And I was like, I don't know, man, not the best.
And they never changed it.
Yeah, no, they never did. They never bulked him out. Never gave him a slightly cooler stance. So yeah, I think I'd go with R2.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. Been
thanks for having
very
me.
Interesting
a lot of fun.
Conversation. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Absolutely. Have a great one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, there you go. Very interesting interview with Brian Stillman.
If you'd like to support what we do here at Talk Star Wars, then head to patreon.com/talkstarwars and become a patron. Your support will help us as we expand our programming to include further shows, and in return, you'll get access to an exclusive VIP Facebook group, a monthly prize draw, weekly Facebook live sessions, priority release podcasts, an exclusive daily podcast, and a whole lot more. Head to patreon.com/talkstarwars today and become a TSW patron.
So that's the Talk Star Wars Patreon group. I advise you all to join that, as it's great fun to join the Facebook Lives on a Thursday and also the group every day. Before I go, I just want to mention on the 14th of October, the Kingfisher Shopping Centre in Redditch, we are going to be having a meetup. We're going to be having a table at Echo Live. You'll be able to meet me, Rob Wade, and Jeremy Rowling there, as well as some other actors from the Star Wars world. But the main thing there is vintage Star Wars goodness. There'll be plenty of dealers there selling their wares. So head to Echo Base on Facebook for details of that. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Talk Star Wars Toy Box. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm at TSW Toy Box Daily on Twitter. You can also contact Rob on at Rob Wade Vision and Jeremy at Rowling Jeremy. But you can also join us all on the TSW Toy Box page on Facebook, which is our community, to show you all our wares, all our collections, show your collections and your toy runs. So I hope to see you all at Kingfisher Shopping Centre in Redditch on the 14th of October. And if you don't, you can also catch me daily on the Talk Star Wars Toy Box Daily, Monday to Friday. And sometimes you get a bonus episode on a Saturday or Sunday, or on a Facebook Live on a Sunday. So I will see you then. May the toys be with you.
It's a wrap.
It's a wrap.